ask Catherine. I'm going to defer our questions so that I can do them with Franklin. We're going to focus, of course, as we usually do, on the precious metals market report. We've already got some good questions in the instant teleseminar, so I would encourage you to post your questions. So I am in Western Tennessee, but Franklin has been off traveling around the nation with his lovely wife, Susan, and he is in Chattanooga. Are you with us, Franklin?
I supper tonight at one of the best restaurants in the country and the world, and that is the Boathouse in Chattanooga. It is so unique. It's not like any place you've ever eaten. And Lawton is just an entrepreneur who's been doing this all his life, and it was just fabulous. We had supper with him and his wife, Karen, and just if you ever get to Chattanooga, you have to eat at the Boathouse.
Well, you know, the last time I was in Chattanooga, I did eat at the Boathouse with you, and it was wonderful. You know, Chattanooga is a town I think is one of the great cities of America. It's
you know, they've done a lot of work in recent years to restore the downtown, and they have a lot of great restaurants. They have the best aquarium I've ever been to anywhere in the world, and it's just a really interesting place. But it's an example of what you can do with a local economy just with a little effort. And, you know, the thing is, I mean, I know that we concentrate on all of the losers in the world, you know, the people who are sucking off the government and so forth, and all the clowns in the government who are trying to steal from us and make life impossible. But the fact is that a lot of people like Lawton Haygood out there, who are, you know, it doesn't matter. Nothing stops them. They just keep working. It doesn't matter
right. How
bad the atmosphere becomes. They just keep on working away. And, you know, I think every one of us ought to be thankful for folks like that.
Well, you know, I think Chattanooga is an example of what happens with real leadership locally. Because I remember when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I knew some of the people who'd been involved. You had a group of local families get together and say, what do we, you know, the economy's changing. What do we need to make Chattanooga a wonderful place to be? And they went to work over many, many years and invested a great deal of time and their personal time and money to really sit down and say, you know, what are the 100,000 things that make a place wonderful for everybody? And I think Chattanooga is one of the great examples in the country of local leadership. So I'm excited that you're enjoying it. Okay, so Franklin, just bring us up to date on the market since we talked last. How's the market doing?
Well, let me answer that question obliquely by answering how I'm doing. And I use myself the same way miners used to use a canary in a mine. You know, they would take a canary down in the mine with them because if the canary keeled over and died, they knew there was too much methane in the mine and they had to get out. And I think I'm kind of the canary in the mine. And so I've learned to watch myself and start to keel over, I know something's going on. I think the situation today is a lot like the situation was in December of 2008 or January of 2009. We had to a terrible bottom in the gold market, gold and silver, in November. We didn't know that was the bottom. Gold was at 705, went as low as 880. Now, those are the paper prices. The physical prices never went that low. And it looked like, you know, the end of the world. Stocks kept on going down from then until April, I think, when they bottomed. And it was just scary, Catherine. There's just no other way to put it. It was just completely frightening. And I found myself having to force my reasonable mind onto the situation and onto my emotions, because my emotions said, run for cover. There's nothing you can do. And my better mind said, no, you're in the middle of a bull market, and you've got to go with that. And these are the kinds of terrors that periodically pass over bull markets and make us think that they're over, and it's nothing more than the bull trying to shake off as many bettors as possible. And I've really been thinking about this a lot and struggling through it, trying to get my mind right, because we've been in a correction since August in both gold and silver, since the 1st of October. And it appears they have broken out of their long corrections. And indeed they have, but they've come back in this correction. And I sent you some charts, and I specifically sent weekly charts because that's a longer-term view of the market. And if you look at the weekly gold chart, you see it's okay. There's nothing, nothing's happened. Gold could go down to 1,500 and actually nearly 1,400 and still remain in the same uptrend that it has been in since 2001.
Franklin, I just wanted to mention, we have three charts up on the blog that are 10-year charts, and the charts that Franklin's referring to will be up on the blog by tomorrow morning and will be in the transcript. Okay? Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was a little late getting them to you. But if you look at the monthly silver chart, you see the same kind of pattern. You see that we've come down to the bottom of the channel, of the trading channel, haven't broken through. And even sometimes, markets break through that bottom line for a little bit. You can see they did that in 2008. And it is frightening, but you have to keep reminding yourself, our strategy is not to trade in and out with daily or even monthly or even six monthly trends. What we're doing is we're riding a long-term primary trend, and that's where our profit is. And we have to ask ourselves, has this long-term primary trend changed? And the answer is no, because the drivers have not changed. And I probably say this every time we talk on the Solari program, that you have to keep going back to these fundamentals and asking yourself, did I make a mistake? Has anything changed? And the answer is no. And you've just seen that in fiscal cliff, ridiculous fiscal cliff farce. They didn't change anything. they can't change anything. You mentioned just a few minutes ago how many people, somewhere over 50% of the people, take their income from the federal government. The institutional structure is such that the inflation is built in, and therefore silver and gold will continue to rise. And as scary as it gets sometimes when you get these, deflation scares, or it appears that things have turned, you still have to keep looking and asking yourself that one basic fundamental question: what drivers have changed? And if the drivers have not changed, then the trend hasn't changed. So,
I look at things much more politically. So I tend to look at economic warfare more than the charts. And I think the big question for me was what caused the down in December. And my assessment is, I think the Department of Justice made a deal with HSBC to knock the price down. I think that was part of the settlement over the money laundering, because you have the announcement in the, that morning and that day, suddenly massive sales of gold. Well, who is HSBC? They're the custodian for GLD. So, I think there was a real intervention. And my guess is that it was critical to getting the fiscal cliff deal negotiated. So, but I think, if you look at all the different tea leaves, Franklin, let me step back, because I don't want to get ahead to 2013. Let's just go back. And let me just say to everyone, I went back and took a look at what my predictions were for the 2012. And I have to tell you, I was not right. Because I said I thought the precious metals market was going to clearly outperform the equity markets. And this is the first time, you know, we're talking about gold as though things were tough in 2012. We have to remember that they were up. Gold, depending on which numbers you use, was up 4 to 7%. So, you know, we did get a positive return. So we're so used to positive returns, Franklin, that I think, you know, there's some markets where if you get 4%, you're thrilled. But this is the first year that, you know, if you go back and you look at the 10-year chart, that's why I put it up, the gold and precious metals has so outperformed the equity markets, you know, whether it's US, Europe, even Asian, so outperformed, it's mind-boggling the extent to which they've outperformed. But this was the first year they didn't. And I think that's kind of what's got everybody shaking their heads. And me too, because, you know, I went back, I told you this last year, I went back and I said, over the last 12 years, there's been a pattern of being up double digits every 2 years and then up single digits. So this is the first time we've only been single digit on gold 2 years in a row. And I guess my sense of the thing is that a lot has been going on behind the scenes to clean up the financial coup. And they don't want to see inflation until after that's, you know, they're in a position to let what they own now rise. And I see a lot of movement to get that moving and done. And so to me, I think there is a lot to say that we're going to be looking in reinflation, and where the big question mark is for me, because I said stock market have trouble in 2012 with precious metals outperforming. I said it'd be 2000 by the end of the year, and clearly was wrong. It was approximately 1650. My big question going forward is, will they let precious metals run too far ahead of the equity markets? Because to keep the game going, they can't afford for the bond market to unravel, which means they can't afford for the stock market to unravel. So I think there was a real effort coming into the fiscal cliff deal to get the precious metals market, which had really, you know, was way ahead of equities and would have outperformed equity for the year, sort of back in the tent. And I think that's the big question in 2013 is, can the central bankers manage it in lockstep with the other markets?
Well, just a footnote to that, they did all of that between the end of November and the end of December.
Right.
Almost all of that move came in that period of time. I think that the stock market has another problem from my standpoint, and that is, if you look at a very long-term chart of the stock market, you see a gigantic shoulders formation in not just in the U.S. stock markets, but in all world stock markets. And the downside targets on those, you know, the measuring rule for head and shoulders top is to take the height of the head and apply that to the breakout point of the neckline. And if you do that, you get ridiculous targets. You get zero targets, basically, or below zero targets, which is extremely disturbing because it implies that there's some sort of catastrophe out there. And I'm not making this up from some preconception. I'm just talking about what the technical pattern describes. And so in the last 5 years or so, the stock market has formed a broadening top, which is also called a jaws of death formation. And it appears in March or so it will hit the top of that, the Dow will hit the top of that jaws of death formation. And once it does, I mean, it's a multi-century top. When I say multi-century, I mean since 1720. And so that would indicate a long, long period to follow when stocks will fall. In addition to that, there's the problem of the bond market that you mentioned. In the last 2 weeks, the bond market, the yield on the 10-year treasury has broken out to the upside. Now, what is significant about that? Well, what's significant about that is that the Fed's whole program has been zero interest rate policy. And one of the questions that you had sent to me that one of your subscribers forwarded was in response to my comment that the Fed does not control interest rates. And, you know, I don't think they do. I think the market does. They control things at the margin. But if masses of people in the market say, you know, I don't want to hold these bonds anymore, then they're going to start selling bonds. And when they sell bonds, that means interest rates are going to rise. And so I think that's the biggest
problem. Well, but here's the question. Because what we're looking at is we're looking at a huge upside-down pyramid of paper in the bond market, in the derivatives market. And when that money, when it leaves, it's got to go to real estate. It's got to go to the stock market. It's got to go to precious metals. You know, it's got to go somewhere. And I think, you know, I'm not as negative on the stock market as you, but if you look at the trends, one of the most positive trends in the stock market is money leaving the bond market looking for someplace to go. Because even if a long bond offers 5% yield, you're better off getting a 5% yield in a real company that's doing something real, that's not just a piece of paper. And it's a financial asset, so it's not a coin you put in your pocket, but it's a real group of people doing something that's useful. Whereas a lot of the bond paper is... So that's the big question. If the money starts to leave the bond market, where is it going to go?
Well, exactly. And that of course would be good for stocks, but at the same time, it would indicate the beginning of a flight out of the dollar, which is a whole, you know, brings with it a whole basket of other problems. So the Fed is they've painted themselves as usual into a corner where they must keep interest rates low or risk unleashing catastrophe on not just one market but all across all markets. And I, you know, there's no question in my mind. I keep looking at these charts. I look at the stock, at the currency charts, the three major currencies, and the two major U.S. stock indices, and the Treasury bond, the 10-year Treasury yield, and gold and silver. And I watch those all the time, and they don't look right. And by what I mean, when I say they don't look right, in the last 6 months to a year, they have been so filled with these jerky gaps. And markets don't usually gap. You know, gaps are, if you read one of the classic works on technical analysis like Edwards and McGee, you'll see them talking about gaps, but gaps are really supposed to be unusual. And yet I see them constantly in these markets. And what it says to me is that the government is manipulating markets. They're in there buying and selling to push them one way or the other. Either that or the people who are trading are so confused and so driven by the latest news item that they jump from one thing to the other immediately, and that leaves these gaps on the chart. But it's not
well,
normal.
I would say it a different way, because if you look, I wanted to go back, because you were much more bullish on precious metals last year than I was, and I think you are right now still. You know, both of us, I think we both strongly feel that this isn't a long-term bull market, and the bull is far from over. But, you know, if you look at what we got wrong last year, we underestimated the ability of the system to manage the markets and control them and direct them. Is that fair to say?
It might be. That certainly is the most obvious hypothesis to explain the failure, because if you look at the corrections that we saw in silver and gold, you just have the... Now, it might be natural in the market, but I get the impression that somebody kept driving those markets down to that 1526 point and that $26 point in the 1526 in gold and the $26 point in silver over and over and over. And usually that doesn't happen. You know, usually if you hit right. a mark three times, third time it breaks through and breaks down.
Well, I guess, you know, I've watched these folks manage the markets for a year, but never this centrally, that never this controlled, that never this blatantly. And I think the big question is, and of course, as you know, I think they want a rising gold price because they're, you know, once you've stolen all the assets, you want to go back to a sound currency. You don't, you know, you use a fiat currency to get control, but once you get control, sound currency works in your favor. So I've always thought they wanted a managed rise. They just want to hold things together. And another way to look at what has happened with what I call the financial coup d'etat, you know, they've sucked a huge amount of money out of the machine. And one of the reasons they did it, Franklin, was they couldn't figure out a way to get the American, federal government budget on a financially responsible basis. You know, the theory being you had tremendous number of constituencies, whether powerful or not powerful, all of who just wanted their check, and nobody was willing to, you know, take responsibility for the whole. So they said, fine, we'll just pull all the money. And the way we'll pull the money is we'll issue lots of fraudulent paper, we'll stuff it in your retirement accounts and pension funds, and then you'll wake up and you're basically a contingent liability owed to yourself. You know, there's a perfect virtuous circle of phony baloney paper in your retirement pensions, and when you screw yourself, you'll, you know, it just goes around in a big circle. So the big question has always been, what's the end game? And nobody knows what that is. But that's what we're sitting and watching, you know, all the different political constituencies coming into Washington to argue, to battle this out. And for the first time, you know, we're not going to be able to just print more paper and hand it out. So somebody's going to have to get cut, and there's going to have to be a certain amount of accountability, you know, whether it's positive or negative or smart or stupid. But for the first time, you know, it's going to behave like you have to optimize a real budget and there's limited resources. So I kind of see one pot of money that's now $20 to $40 trillion offshore, free and clear, and another pot of paper that's all stuck and yelling at each other. And it's almost as though there's a complete divide and separation within the economy between these two pots of money. And the second pot is ready to come in and have a party. And if they decide to do it, $20 to $40 trillion is enough to keep a lot of things floating around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I confess I'm a double-minded man, and there are a lot of things that I can see both sides of, and I can't really come to one conclusion or the other. But one of the things that I think is true at some level of management is that the debt doesn't matter, and it doesn't, from their standpoint, it doesn't have to be run like a household economy, because
right.
A household economy cannot print money, whereas they can. And
right.
And the problem is that does not mean that they can just keep printing money forever, because if they go too far, then they wind up in a hyperinflation and it blows up everything. So their situation is different, but it's still limited. There are still certain natural limitations of it.
Well, what's your prediction for 2013? What do you think
okay.
we have to look forward to?
Okay, I'm going to talk about numbers only. And I ran some numbers on gold and silver, and you know that, you know what Elliott wave theory is, and I'm no Elliott
uh-huh.
wave technician. No, I don't know sic'em from come here about Elliott wave, just a little bit. But mainly you can see in any analysis of the way markets move that they go up in three waves. They go up one wave, down one, up the third, down the fourth, and up the fifth. And generally, the third wave is never the shortest, and the fifth wave is oftentimes the very longest. And we're in a third wave now, and a third wave is never shorter than a wave. And so looking at that and thinking about that and looking at what, you know, the time frames that moves in the first wave took, how long they lasted, and the percentage moves that they made, I keep coming back to this $2,300 price by the 1st of June. And I, you know, I wish I could come up to something else, but there it is. It just shows up $2,300 by the 1st of June, and the target for this move is about $4,500. And that's just based on the first wave up, and so these prices in this wave ought to exceed the percentage gains in that wave. Now,
right.
You know, that it's just numbers. That's all I can, you know, that's the only thing I can go from is just those numbers.
Well, for a long time now, I've been looking, you know, because I have clients who've been in for a long, long time, and so they have very high percentages just because it's done so well. And for a long time, I've wanted to rebalance at 1850, and it hasn't gotten there. So I'm very keen to see 1850 by mid-March. And I think the first and second quarter will tell us a great deal about what the wherewithal of the system is to keep the price, you know, kind of rising with general inflation. And I don't know, Franklin. I'm confident that it's going to keep rising. I'm confident that we're in a long-term bull market, but I know there's tremendous political pressure to keep it somewhat in the same inflation range with the U.S. equity markets. And I don't know the extent to which they can, you know, they can keep it within that range or not. But I do think we're coming into a significant inflation, and they're looking for a lot of money in the bond market to be free to shift into other things, and real estate one of them. So I think the environment's going to be generally inflation. And as you've always said, these guys have a deep, deep commitment to inflation. So I think, yeah. So I think if the market was free to trade, your charts would make a lot of sense. And the question is, how much can they sit on it and manage it down, you know, so that it keeps track with the other markets? And that's a big question for me. And I think we'll see a lot in the first two quarters. And of course, the big surprise we're in for, the wild card, is if interest rates shoot up, and then everybody's in trouble everywhere. So, you know, that's going to...
The Fed certainly does not want to see that happen. If the worst, you know, the worst they would accept is a slow rise in the interest rate. They certainly don't want them to shoot up, because that would hurt the stock market too. You know, I mean,
it's going to hurt, and it's going to hurt precious metals. It'll hurt everything. It'll be across the board. My feeling is if the precious metals market price were to spike up too fast, or interest rates were to spike up too fast, because those are really the smoke alarms. If they spike up too fast, I think there's war. Because I don't think these markets clear with price. As you know, I think they clear with war. So anyway, so I'll just say my goal is by the end of June, I'd be most grateful if we could hit 1850, and I think there's a reasonably good chance. But the big question mark for me is, and I hope I'm wrong, and I hope you're right. I'm rooting for you, Franklin.
Yeah. Well, let me go back to something you just said. You know, I don't think most people, I think most people do not realize that if you look at the world in 1913 or 1914, what you would see is almost an ideal world. And nobody would think that Germany would go to war with France and Great Britain,
right.
And nobody would think that they would go to war with Russia, because the system of interlocking alliances was so tight, and the threat of war so overwhelming. You know, the forces were so evenly balanced. Nobody would have expected that. Well, today, you have the European Union and everybody just hugging and kissing each other over there, and everybody's all lovey-dovey, and how could a war ever happen? don't kid yourself. War turns around overnight. And so when you say that war would be the trump card that they would pull out to play, I think you're absolutely right. I have no doubt.
Right, and I think we've seen tremendous covert wars going on. I mean, we have boots on the ground in the Middle East, but I think the covert warfare has risen steadily and will continue. So this could be a very violent period. And of course, that's my chief concern. Well, let me turn to some of the questions, because we have some really good questions. One is, will the value of precious metals be threatened if we move to another type of currency, whether carbon-based or not?
No, the reason, you know, given that there would be fluctuations, the reason that you want to buy precious metals is because they are currencies themselves. You know, they are alternatives to every other currency. So, you know, they offer us a way to carry you across currency transitions from one currency to another. So even though there might be some loss there, I don't know any better way you could do it.
Right.
I mean, maybe buy D-cell batteries or something. I don't know, but I don't know any better way you could carry value across.
To me, the big threat to precious metals is technology. If we were to get extraordinary amounts of new technology being made available, particularly that would drop the energy price, you know, dramatically, that could change the fundamentals on a lot of things, including precious metals. But I think that's certainly unlikely in 2013. Paul Craig Roberts suggests that one of the ways the Fed keeps the price of gold depressed is by naked short selling on the futures market, perfectly willing to pay the penalty for defaulting on the contract. What happens when a party sells shorts and then defaults on the contract?
Well, if they can't deliver, they have to go buy at market price and deliver. But generally, one of the things, I hate to say this, but I have to, one of the things you have to understand is that the game is rigged. And so what the futures market often does is that when there are a lot of people, who, especially dealers, you know, on the futures market who can't deliver, then they either they change the rules in some way so that those people are bailed out. And one of the ways they do that is by so-called cash settlement.
Right.
That is, let's
and they've done that
out.
Before.
Oh gosh, yeah. Shit, that's the reason there's no longer a potato market. Well, used to, there were potato futures, and they did that in the potato futures. What happens is they say, well, let's say you're the other, you're the long on the other side of my short, and I owe you 5,000-ounce bars of silver. And they say, well, he can't pay, and so he can just give you cash, the cash equivalent for whatever the market price is right now. Well, you and I both know that by doing that, you take huge pressure off of the physical supply.
Right.
And that's the futures markets are run for the benefit of the futures merchants. They're not run for the benefit of the public. And the public doesn't generally understand that. But they will figure out a way to bail everybody out. And this question, though, goes more to, what about the government short selling? And the answer is there's more than one way to sell short. You don't necessarily have to sell short on the futures, you know, the COMEX futures market. You can sell short in the over-the-counter market just as well. Or you can sell SLV or GLD short and accomplish the same thing. I mean, I'm convinced that's the way they manipulate the stock market. They don't go in and buy 10,000 shares of General Motors. They go in and they, if they want to buy, they buy the futures. They buy the spider, you know, the SPY futures or Dow futures. And when arbitrageurs see that futures price rising against the index price, then they will rush in and buy the underlying index, the underlying stocks, in order to take advantage of that little spread difference. And so that's the way that, that the market's manipulated. So they don't just have to sell in the futures market. But the answer to the question, I'm sorry, I've wandered. The answer to the question is they just decree cash settlement and screw all of the longs. That's right. The way it's done.
Okay. January 4th saw an early market disparity between physical prices and paper equivalents. Physical was up 1% and paper was down 1.5%. I heard you say this happens frequently. What is the cause? And on this one, he's talking about the silver market.
Right. Well, let me just say that people who think that the paper price of silver and the physical price of silver are the same are tremendously misled. The most blatant example of that occurred in the fall of 2008, when there was a 50% or more difference between the price of physical silver and the price of paper silver. Literally, you had $12 physical silver and $8 or $9 paper silver. And what we've seen in the last, since October, beginning of November at least, is a shortage of almost all low premium gold coins and a shortage of 90% silver coin that has taken the premium on 90% silver coin from a nickel under spot at wholesale to today 95 cents over spot if you can find it, and many dealers are not selling 90% silver coin because they don't know when they'll be able to buy it. In other words, these low prices have driven all of those coins into hiding, the silver coins and the small gold coins. 50 pesos, Mexican 50 pesos, that's a coin that we love to sell because it has a low premium. There are not any of them out there. 90% coin, it's the same way. So
you've seen this happen so many times.
See, what that tells me is there. I don't care what the paper price is doing. There is a shortage. And I actually hear analysts who I otherwise have respect for saying that there's no physical for silver. I don't know what they're talking about. I really don't, because in my world, when the price of something goes up, that means that there's higher physical demand for it. So when you see that disparity, what it usually tells me, if the paper price is down more than the silver price, then what it tells me is that either the nice government men are manipulating the price, or else there's some kind of panic in the market on that gets paper investors, that convinces paper they ought to sell. But it's not
We're getting a flood of questions.